is Americana. Change comes slowly in the Ozarks, and the hill folks are still close to the pioneer way of life. When I first visited this region in 1899, there were no highways, no automobiles, no jukeboxes or movies. People spent their evenings at home without any radio. They didn't read much. They entertained themselves and their children with songs, riddles, games, and stories. These were part of an oral tradition handed down from one generation to the next, first from one isolated hilltop to another. The early settlers had little of our modern enthusiasm for novelties. They did not feel, as we do, that a new song or a new story is better than an old one.
The words you have just heard are from the introduction to Vance Randolph's Who Blowed Up the Church House? This program is Americana, the 15th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight we bring you Stories from Home.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. Most novelists these days try to write important novels. It's a sort of tradition. I suppose they feel that they have to say something significant and penetrating and eternal about the nature of the world and man. The notion that every young writer is the potential author of the great American novel still seems to be with us. I suppose that a young fellow who announced that he intended to write a small American novel would be drummed out of the Authors League of America forthwith. I've nothing in the world against great novels, of course, but it's always cheering to me to see a small novel, an unpretentious novel, a yarn spinner's novel appear from time to time and become exceedingly popular. Now, I don't mean the sort of book that you would describe as trashy or ill-written. I'm thinking about the kind of story that exists apparently just for the pleasure that a writer and a number of readers get out of a story which is told with gusto and humor. All this is by way of introducing the fact that I, along with a good many other people, have come across an extremely entertaining novel called No Time for Sergeants by a new writer whose name is Mac Hyman. I first noticed Mr. Hyman's book in the bookstores last November or thereabouts. And since I have an interest in sergeants, which dates back a number of years, I made a mental note to get hold of a copy and read it as soon as possible. By the time I acquired my copy, the book was already in its sixth printing and had appeared on the bestseller lists around the country. And apparently it's still gaining in popularity. Well, having read No Time for Sergeants, I can understand why this should be so. It's a very funny book. I can best describe it to you briefly by saying that it's the kind of book that might have resulted if Voltaire's Candide had been written by Mark Twain. I don't mean to say that Mr. Hyman is necessarily as good either as Voltaire or as Mark, but that's the general style of the work. No Time for Sergeants is the story of Will Stockdale, a nice young fellow who lives with his pa out in the country. The country happens to be the back hills of Georgia, but that's not important. The important point is that Will is an innocent, oversized, friendly young fellow who is anxious to do good for his fellow man. The trouble is that things just seem to get too complicated for him. You take the matter of how he was called up for the draft. The story begins with Will and his pa just finishing up a day of fishing. Pa has fallen to dozing on the front porch when Will hears the sound of a car approaching. Cars are pretty rare things in their part of the country. All the dogs and chickens raise an excited clamor.
So it was pretty much of a surprise to me, too, because, well, for a minute there, it looked like the car weren't going to stop at all. I mean, come heading right for us and didn't begin to stop until it was about 30 feet from the porch. Then it jolted with dust blowing up past it and stopped. And jumped forward again and finally come to a halt. Then the door slammed. And this little fat, round-faced fella, he come walking through the cloud of dust, talking just as hard as he could. Couldn't hear what he was saying, though. All he could hear was sounds and see his mouth moving because there was so much racket all around. And it was really surprising. I mean, it looked like he was raving somehow. He was either doing that or preaching. And it didn't seem natural to me that a fellow would come riding up in a car that way and jump out and start preaching, even though I did know one fellow who used to jump out at you from behind the bushes and start preaching. But didn't seem that way somehow. With all the racket going on, you just couldn't tell what he was doing. Anyhow, Paul usually wa'n't in such good humor when he woke up, easy and casual-like. I mean, it usually took him a half hour or so to manage it, and he wa'n't in much of a humor then. And waking up with dogs barking and chickens howling and a man stomping up and talking that way was pretty much of a shock to him, any way you look at it. I sees his eyes blinking and his jaws moving before he was halfway up. And then he stood up there for a second, shaking his head, trying to get his bearings, and looking down at the fella like he hadn't ever seen anything like him in his life before. And all his time, the man kept on talking. I caught the words. "I want to see Will Stockdale. Now, is that you or ain't it? Because I've been riding for several days now." That's all I could make out. We kept on with it. Then he raised one finger up, and he started wiggling it at me and saying something else. But about that time, I guess, being half asleep the way he was, Paul yelled out, "Don't you point your finger in my boy's face. That ain't got nothing to do with it. If this boy knows what's good for him, he'll get in that car right now and head back to town with me, and he won't have any more trouble about it. You folks out here think that just because you live 10,000 miles from town, you all don't have to do things like anybody else. But I'm here to tell you different. I've been over the roads that ain't even been discovered yet. And I've been down trails that nothing but a horse and wagon has been down. And this is the third time I've been to find this place here. And I mean it's the last time, too." And he kept on like that for a pretty good while. And he kept Paul from busting in again, but then he said, "I wrote you four letters, and I ain't got an answer to none of them. And you needn't say that you can't read, neither. Because you could have got somebody to read them to you, and that ain't no excuse." Which was about the most foolish thing he could have said, it seems like to me, because Pa weren't going to take that from nobody. And he didn't, neither. He drawled himself up like real quick, like with his eyes all lit up, and he looked down on the fella and just bellowed out at him, "By God, sir, do you mean to stand there and say to my face that my son can't read?"
Well, you can see from this the kind of trouble that Will gets into, without meaning to at all, of course. As a matter of fact, the process of getting Will into the Army of the United States involves a small infantry action, a few police officers, a night in jail, and various other things. And as Will says all along, he's perfectly willing to go into the draft, though not exactly crazy about it. Anyway, the Air Force gets Will, and as time goes on, the Air Force quite naturally begins to wonder if Will is really worth all the bother that they went to in getting him into the service. The wondering starts with a certain Sergeant King, who has Will assigned to his unit during the classification process and thereafter can't get rid of him. And then there's Ben, another draftee, who's pretty unhappy in the Air Force because his great-grandpa fought with Stonewall Jackson, and his dad was in the Rainbow Division, and he figures that he ought to uphold the family tradition by going into the infantry, too. Now, I'm not going to try to tell you what happens to Will in the Air Force, but I will give you a sample from the very end of the book, which will, I'm sure, suggest to you that a very great deal has happened. Will is saying to an Air Force general who has just finished pinning medals on him and Ben,
"Well, it's pretty nice," I said. "And we do want you to know how much we appreciate it." But he didn't answer. He just stood there a minute and then kind of turned away and started for the house again. So everything worked out pretty good that way, and when I heard Sergeant King was going to get to go along too with us, I felt pretty good about things. Me and Ben, we went out and we sat in the car, and after a little bit, Sergeant King come out and he got in the car too, and the driver started off, and I felt so lively and everything, I reached over and I popped Ben in the back and I said, "Ben, see there? We got a medal after all. We ain't even dead besides. And you were right about the Air Force, too, because the medals are..." The driver turned around and he said, "Air Force? You fellas in the infantry now." "Infantry," Ben said. "That's right, buddy. As if now you fellas are transferred. Your new uniform's in the back there, and as soon as we get to the airport, you'll have a chance to change. Yes, sir. You're in the infantry now." "You had it, buddy." Then Ben looked at me with his big smile spreading across his whole face. He reached up and touched a medal hanging off his chest and said, "Well, I'll be danged. We made the infantry after all." And he seemed mighty happy about it. Sergeant King was, too, I think. He sat there staring out of the window for the longest sort of time. Didn't say a word. Just like he couldn't believe it, almost. And when Ben said, "Yes, sir. Well, we're just like the Three Musketeers. I bet we stay in the same outfits, and I bet we have everything all the time the same. All the time we're in the infantry." Sergeant King got so excited over it, he sat there and he just quivered, just like the general had done, all the way to the airport.
Mr. Hyman's book has a great many ancestors in the history of literature. None of them perhaps entirely respectable works, but all of them quite delightful. There would be the most illegal adventures of Jonathan Wild, the highwayman, and perhaps the stories of Candide and that most celebrated knight, Don Quixote de la Mancha. I might be quite wrong, of course, but I should say that No Time for Sergeants is a picaresque novel. That is to say, it's a rambling story of the adventures of a colorful and eccentric character, which draws rather heavily upon the styles and materials of folk tales. That is, of course, why I've enjoyed the adventures of Will Stockdale so thoroughly. Will's a familiar American hero, a bulletproof innocent in a sophisticated world. It's true that he comes from the back hills of Georgia, and most of us have never visited that country, but that doesn't matter. Will's a country boy, and we've all known his story. His style is mostly American rural. His story is, in a pleasant, familiar way, a story from home. I wonder why more writers don't make use of folk tales in their stories. The raw material is rich and delightful, and there's an enormous amount of it. Certainly the collectors and preservers of folklore have done their share in getting it into print. I'm probably not doing justice to the folklorists in describing their produce as raw material. It's more than that. It's literature just as it stands. Consider, for instance, three books by Mr. Vance Randolph, which I've been reading of late. Mr. Randolph has for some 30 years been collecting the folklore of the Ozark country. So, of course, his material is quite similar in general style to that which Hyman has used so well in No Time for Sergeants. The three books in question are Ozark Superstitions, We Always Lie to Strangers, and, this is the best title I've seen in a long time, Who Blowed Up the Church House? All of these books are published by the Columbia University Press. What interests me most about these books is the important place allotted to storytelling by Mr. Randolph's Ozark neighbors. In an introduction to Who Blowed Up the Church House, he writes,
"Change comes slowly in the Ozarks, and the hill folk are still close to the pioneer way of life. When I first visited this region in 1899, there were no highways, no automobiles, no jukeboxes, no movies. People spent their evenings at home without any radio. They didn't read much, but entertained themselves and their children with songs, riddles, games, and stories. These were part of an oral tradition, handed down from one generation to the next, passed from one isolated hilltop to another. The early settlers had little of our modern enthusiasm for novelty. They didn't feel as we do that a new song or a new story is better than an old one. The telling of tales was a social accomplishment, not a profession. Fiddlers who played the country dances were generally paid, but nobody made any money out of storytelling. Farmers swapped stories in their own homes and at small neighborhood gatherings. The finest yarns were spun by the flicker of log fires and seemed less effective in lighted rooms. The men and women who told me these stories didn't read them in any book. Many of the items here presented are not considered fit for children's ears today. But they were common household stories 50 years ago, and most rural youngsters heard them. These people are old now, but they've not forgotten. The tales are still told occasionally when old-timers get together."
Anyone might anticipate that in a rural, pre-industrial society, folk arts would be practiced and enjoyed. What interests me is Randolph's comment that storytelling in the Ozarks is an essential part of living. It's all right to pay a man for fiddling at a country dance, but no one gets paid for storytelling any more than people get paid for breathing. Storytelling thus becomes a kind of technique for getting along in the world, a way of dealing with experience. All other folk arts then fall into their places around this essential center of yarn spinning, like planets circling a sun. For the storyteller dramatizes, even creates, the world in which people live. The odd beliefs and practices which Randolph records in his Ozark Superstitions then become adornments of that world, and to some extent, material for news stories.
Perhaps the most striking feature of the Ozarkers' New Year's behavior is their reluctance to allow anything to be taken out of the house on January 1st. I once knew a woman who absent-mindedly carried a bucket of ashes out on New Year's morning. She was shaken almost to the point of hysteria, and the whole family was horrified, although nobody seemed to know just what specific calamity was supposed to result. Many broad-minded modernists pretend that there's no harm in carrying something out, provided you're careful to take something else in. Thus, it's permissible to throw out a pan of potato peelings if one immediately lugs in a bucket of water or an armload of wood. The real old-timers figure it's safer not to carry anything out of the cabin on January 1st, but to pack in as much stuff as possible. Some old folks take this so seriously that they'll not allow anyone to enter on that day without depositing something, even if it's only a few walnuts or a handful of chips. This precaution, according to the old tradition, ensures a whole year of plenty for the people who live in that house.
Ain't much trouble just for one day.
That's what an old man said as he insisted that I get a stick from the woodpile before coming into his shanty.
And me and Ma, we don't aim to take no chances.
To speak of superstitions is, of course, to come around sooner or later to the matter of ghosts and witches. And this sort of material is naturally part of the great body of anecdote, legend, and yarn spinning generally. Unfortunately, the belief in ghosts appears to be waning in the Ozarks, though it's not quite gone.
Mrs. May Kennedy McCord of Springfield, Missouri, thinks that the decay of ghost stories in the Ozarks is due to the fact that there are so few really lonesome places nowadays. In order to raise a good crop of ghosts, she says, we must have a lot of old mills and deserted houses and covered bridges. And these romantic spots are not so common as they used to be. There are many humorous cracks about the hillman's belief in ghosts. One ancient wheeze refers to a superstitious fella who was afraid to walk past the graveyard at night. His friends tried to build up his morale, assuring him that ghosts have never been known to hurt anybody. Maybe not, said the hill man.
But I just don't want him a-following me around.
An old gentleman in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, talked freely about pioneer customs, folk songs, and play parties, and even duels. But when asked for local ghost stories, he had nothing to contribute.
There's ghosts in Texas and maybe in Oklahoma, but not here.
I waited a long moment without any comment.
This country is just naturally too rough for ghosts.
That's what he said finally. Anybody who's visited Eureka Springs will understand exactly what the old gentleman meant.
But if ghosts are scarce in the Ozarks, witches are not, at least according to Mr. Randolph. He tells a number of stories of witchcraft and sorcery in Ozark superstitions, stories which carry with them the cold chill of belief.
Years ago in Arkansas, I knew a jealous woman who tried to witch the girl who had stolen her man. She set a human skull in a Bible and before it placed two dolls, representing the erring husband and his light of love. The poppet, dressed as a girl, had four great big nails driven into its back. The whole thing was a failure, apparently. I saw the girl several years later, and she seemed in good health and spirits. I once knew a man who spent a half hour or so every evening playing with a wooden spike doll, which was dressed to resemble a local woman who could do things. Time after time, he would thrust the little image into the fireplace until the feet touched the glowing embers and then snatch it out again. The expression on his face was most unpleasant. I'm quite indifferent to the ordinary superstitions of the hill folk. I visit graveyards at night, shoot cats on occasion, and burn sassafras wood without a tremor. And yet, something akin to horror gripped me as I watched the witch master's sadistic foolery. I should not care to have that man burning a poppet wrapped in my undershirt.
Mr. Randolph's book, We Always Lie to Strangers, is mostly a collection of those tales which are told in the Ozarks for the benefit of foreigners. Here are the stories about Mike Fink and Colonel Crockett and the monstrous varmints that infest the back hills, many of which will be more or less familiar to those of you who have read collections of this sort before. Rather than repeat these stories, good as they are, I want to tell you a little about what happens to storytellers when they die. One section in We Always Lie to Strangers deals with the various mythical communities and counties that are sometimes alleged to exist in Arkansas. Places like Possum Trot and Buck Scuffle and Hockey Center and Duck Butter Knob and so on. Well, it's rather a pleasure to learn that the people of the Ozarks have preserved the old notion of Fiddler's Green.
My neighbors in the Ozarks don't believe in purgatory and they never heard of limbo, but many of them refer occasionally to Fiddler's Green, which is several miles the other side of hell. The place was originally set aside for fiddlers only, but later regulations admit banjo pickers and storytellers and ballad singers and other fellows with colorful accomplishments, even if they can't scrape the fiddle. There's sailors and peddlers and tinkers and Fiddler's Green and a few cowpokes and maybe a thin scattering of old soldiers. Some people say that the dance hall girls from West Hell are allowed to come over on Saturday nights. But there's a divergence of opinion about this.
Well, it's rather nice to think that there may be some special provision made for liars and yarn spinners and other literary types in the hereafter. And I suppose that Fiddler's Green is at least as pleasant a place as most of them have any right to expect. The last book, which we now turn to, is Who Blowed Up the Church House? I must say that of Randolph's three volumes, I've enjoyed this one the most, for it's a collection of stories, old and new, written down pretty much the way the Ozark yarn spinners told them. These are stories with a difference, I should guess. Not the kind told to impress strangers, but the stories told at home. I was thinking principally of these pieces when I called this program Stories from Home. I wanted Bill Grisky to tell you one of these stories, and I had some trouble picking the right one. I finally settled on the story of a young fellow named Hiram, partly because it's a very old yarn, partly because it's a good one, and partly because there's fiddle music running all through it.
One time there was a boy named Hiram. He wanted to be a fiddler. These folks got him the best fiddle that money could buy. And old fiddlers from miles around tried to learn him how to play, but weren't no use. Hiram was a smart fella, and he had book learning too, but he was the sorriest fiddler that ever put rosin on a bow. There was a half-wit family lived down the road that couldn't write their own name and didn't know enough to pour chamber lye out of a boot. But they could make a fiddle just talk and sing. Hiram used to listen at them fools a-fiddling, and made him so mad he'd break right down and cry just like a baby. A silly old woman told him that fiddle tunes was hell's own music, and all the best fiddlers is a-working for the devil. Hiram just laughed at that. He said, "That's just a job I was looking for." Only he couldn't play good enough to suit old Scratch. So then Hiram, he started for home, but there was a stranger waiting at the crossroads. "Meet me right here at midnight," says he, and bring your fiddle. And the stranger, he Walked on down the road. Sun was a-shining, but the stranger didn't throw no shadow. There was snow on the ground, but it didn't leave no tracks. Then after that, Hiram was out somewhere, well, pretty nearly every night, and he got to be the blamedest fiddler in the whole darn country. He could play Nancy Rollins and Big Limber till you'd think hell was full of Presbyterians a-dancing with the devil, calling the figures. Hiram could make a fiddle talk all right, but it sure did talk dirty. Yeah, even the names of them reels and hornpipes ain't fit to be wrote down in paper. He could play tunes that would make an old man's hair stand up. And if a woman listened at him a while, oh, she'd just go plumb crazy. There was a gang of rich people from some big town. They'd a camp back in the woods, and they'd always come, and they got Hiram to play for them. And they was a kind of a wild bunch, and lots of times they used to dance all night out there in the timber. Some folks say that the gals at them frolics didn't wear clothes enough to ward a shotgun, and carried on scandalous right before everybody. Home folks figured they must be witches, but probably they was just fancy women that them there fellas brought down from Kansas City. The rich people was having a big party one night when the whole camp burnt up, and everybody says it must have been lightning struck. The home folks, they went over the next day, they scratched around the ashes of them there fine cabins, and yeah, they found some gold watches and a lot of other truck, but there wasn't no bones. Nobody ever did find out went with all those people. Hiram never come home no more neither. And his kinfolks, they was afraid something bad might have happened to him. But maybe Hiram, he just run off with one of those city gals. Maybe he's a fiddling in a dance hall in one of those big towns right now. Or even playing on the radio somewhere.
You have been listening to Americana, the 15th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Music supervision by Maury Streetmatter. Audio engineering by Harold Whitaker. And the quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Grisky. The books discussed on tonight's program were Mac Hyman's No Time for Sergeants, published by Random House, and Vance Randolph's three collections of Ozark folklore, Who Blowed Up the Church House, We Always Lie to Strangers, and Ozark Superstition, all published by the Columbia University Press. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC Radio.